The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS. Philippians 2, 3, and 4 say, "Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves." Our speaker this morning is a man who comports with those verses. He's been very generous in his time and service to ACCS, which means not just to me, but to all of us here. He's traveled far to help promote classical Christian education overseas, as well as within the States. He's been involved with the schools in Jakarta. He's been involved with the schools in northern Iraq and Peru and elsewhere. He's been very selfless and generous in the use of his time and energies and gifting. He's also a very much a modern-day Barnabas. If one thing shines out in all of the evaluations that we receive each year, people are always giantly bolstered and encouraged by his talks. He has the ability to stir our hearts and to motivate weary spirits. He's author of nearly three dozen books on history, politics, theology, social issues, and including best-selling Grand Illusions, The Micah Mandate, and Bringing in the Sheaves. He's a strong advocate for life, pro-life advocate, and he's a director of Kings Meadow Study Center, an instructor at Whitfield Theological Seminary, a teaching fellow at Franklin Classical School, and he's the chancellor of New College Franklin, and a permanent trustee and senior fellow there. He's also a very gracious, godly man, a tender, loving husband, father, grandfather. He's a longtime friend and supporter of me and of ACCS, more importantly. And he's often stated very humbly and graciously that he has no agenda other than just to serve ACCS. And I'm very deeply appreciative of that and of his willing service. So please join with me in welcoming George Grant to our dais.
George, thank you very much.
Behind every great man is a great woman, or so the truism goes. This truism is undoubtedly true of many of us, but it most assuredly was true of the magisterial reformers. Where would Luther have been without his beloved Kate? Or Calvin without Idlet? Or Zwingli without Anna? Of course, it wasn't just their wives that stood behind them. Perhaps one of the most remarkable stories in all of the Reformation are the stories that we don't actually know very well. The stories of the men and the women who sacrificed all that they had to facilitate the work of those who stood in the limelight, those who worked behind the scenes, who took care of the daily details. Indeed, some of the most remarkable heroes in church history were not the frontline leaders. They were the lieutenants. They were like Joshua's and Timothy's behind the Moses's and Paul's. They labored behind the scenes, building the infrastructures, tending to the details, holding down the fort while the visionaries forged ahead end to the limelight. They were the second fiddles. They weren't just followers, though. They were leaders in their own right, in their own spheres. It's just that they weren't necessarily the A-list leaders. They labored just out of the sight of the historians, and thus lay just beyond our own remembrances. They were content with that, willing to work hard in quieter, less obtrusive arenas. Now, realizing that, I believe, can be very instructive, since most of us are not A-list leaders either. These behind-the-scenes heroes provide a realistic model of leadership for us, a servant leader model for our students. They provide a model of leadership for the rest of us. The stories abound, and I could probably, as my outline improperly indicates, tell the stories of all of them. Jerome of Prague, who stood behind Jan Hus, and Philip Melanchthon, who stood behind Martin Luther, and Peter Martyr, who stood behind Martin Bucer, and Martin Bucer, who stood behind John Calvin and Luther and Zwingli and Cranmer. Bullinger, who stood behind Zwingli, Beza, who stood behind Calvin, Groen van Prinsterer, who stood behind Abraham Kuyper, and a host of others. You can just go ahead and take the outline and toss it now, because I don't have time to talk about all of them. I realize that in fitful preparation, after I'd ambitiously put this whole thing together like some crazy A-list leader. But I'd like to tell you a few stories that I think may be instructive. Let's just zoom in on a handful. Melanchthon, Beza, and Bucer. Philip Melanchthon was born in 1497. He was 14 years younger than Martin Luther. He was a remarkable young man who showed great promise at an early age, but that promise seemed to almost be snuffed out when, at the age of 11, his father perished from water that he had drunk from a poisoned well while serving the emperor. Thankfully, an uncle, a great uncle, saw the promise in young Melanchthon and provided him patronage that enabled him to go at the age of 13 to the University of Heidelberg, where he wowed his professors with his ambition and his remarkable intellect. Indeed, he received his bachelor's degree at the age of 14. He went on to Tübingen to study for his master's at the age of 15 and completed that course of study in a little less than 2 years. It was at the time that he was there in Tübingen that the great humanist scholar Erasmus wrote of him, "What promise does this Philip Melanchthon, a youth as yet, almost a boy, give of himself? He is equally at home in Greek and Latin. What acuteness of invention, what purity of diction, what a memory for recondite matters. What extensive reading, what delicate grace and noble talents he displays." Later, he wrote to one of his friends, Erasmus did, saying, "Of Melanchthon, I entertain the most distinguished and splendid expectations. God grant that this young man long survive us, and may he surpass our every accomplishment. He surely will be a bright and shining star for generations to come to admire in the constellation of glory. See, was Melanchthon didn't think much of his own glory. He was fascinated with those who could, unlike him, lead the masses with little more than truth. Not, as he called it, the finagling of ideas and the dolling up of words, but the leading of men and nations by the sheer power of truth. It was evident early on that he was in search of more than just glory for himself. He desired to know the truth and give himself to that truth. For the next several years, he served as a tutor and lecturer at the University of Tübingen and specialized in a series of new translations and clarified texts of the work of Aristotle. He became convinced by studying Aristotle that the medieval scholastics had somehow lost their way. They had misunderstood Aristotle, they had misunderstood philosophy, and perhaps they had misunderstood theology. So when he began to hear tell of a new theology emerging from a brand new university at Wittenberg, his desires turned there. He had, at the age of 21, offers of full professorships at three prominent universities, including at Leipzig. He turned them all down for an opportunity to go and study at this fledgling school. Under this remarkable man named Martin Luther, who was not even a man who specialized in Melanchthon's field, a man who was called coarse, but who Melanchthon believed might be the herald of the truth that he searched for. So in 1519, he joined the faculty of Wittenberg and accompanied Luther in the famous disputation in Leipzig. And suddenly, the whole of Melanchthon's ambitions were turned around. He knew that for the rest of his life, what he wanted to do was to give himself to the cause that Luther was championing. He believed that the scriptures had been abandoned, that grace had been forgotten, that the glories of the legacy of the church had been laid aside for the mere baubles of this world. In 1521, he wrote his most famous book, Loci Communis, in which he described the most basic elements of the Christian life, and he celebrated what he called the commonness of the servant leader's calling. To not grasp at the reins of power, but to revel in the marvels of a grace abounding life. It was Melanchthon who stood side by side with Luther to tend to the details, to hammer out the discussions, to make the negotiations. It was Melanchthon who stood with Luther at the Marburg Colloquy in 1529 and later hammered out the Augsburg Confession in 1530. At the death of Luther in 1546, he very reluctantly took up the mantle of leadership among the German reforming states. Melanchthon is known to many of us just as one more name in a list. He was a remarkable second fiddle. Theodor Beza was born in 1519. He was 10 years younger than John Calvin. Well, like Calvin, he studied with Melchior Vollmar, an early French tutor from the borderlands between Germany and France, and instilled in Beza a love of letters. He went on to study law, but his great passion was literature. He loved composing Latin poetry. He was an accomplished playwright and dramatist. He was a fine artist. He had several incomes that had been passed on to him from his prominent family, and he practiced law pretty much as a leisurely gentleman's affair, and he gave himself altogether to his art. He was not a young child prodigy like Melanchthon. In fact, he wasn't even converted until he was 29 years old. But when he was converted, my, oh my, what a remarkable conversion it was. From 1548 to 1558, Theodore Beza became an ambassador for the French reforming churches. He bounced around. He was a failure at three different startup schools. He knew much travail and trouble, but through it all, wrote some of the most remarkable hymns and poems and dramas displaying the beauty of the gospel. Beza was one who would not agree with Plato. He knew that perhaps poetry was dangerous, but it was that glorious kind of danger that the gospel always brings to men and nations and institutions and powers and principalities. And so he became famous throughout the reforming world, all the while struggling just to make a living. But in 1558, finally, John Calvin persuaded him to come and settle in the city of Geneva, and he quickly made himself indispensable to the great reformer there. Beza did not like the limelight. He wanted his writing to speak for him, but starting up the Genevan Academy, he began to lay foundations for a whole new generation of Genevan leaders to be raised up and to be sent forth. He became the primary discipler of many of the refugees from around the Huguenot world, as well as Scots like John Knox. He spent time and energy focusing on relationships so that John Calvin could retreat to his study to prepare those remarkable sermons and lectures. Calvin said, "He is my right arm. And without him, I cannot imagine what God would have left me with here in Geneva." During the next 5 or 6 years, Beza was remarkably productive. He helped John Knox and a team of scholars hammer out the details of the first study Bible, the Genevan Bible. He began to work on a whole series of biographies and histories, and published 3 volumes of poetry, 2 grammars, 1 French and 1 Greek, prepared new hymns and psalm settings, and provided the very first of the images sent around the world through the miracle of the printing press, the first portraits of all of the magisterial reformers. When Calvin died, it was Theodore Beza who was given the mantle of leadership to pastor the church in Geneva. And as the mantle was laid upon his shoulders, he said, "This is a noxious task to me. For now, I must step out from behind the shadows and stand in the light of day. He was a great second fiddle. Martin Bucer was the great bridge builder of the Reformation. He was born in 1491. He was 8 years younger than Luther and 18 years older than Calvin. He was early on committed to the Dominican order in Heidelberg, but in 1518 he heard Martin Luther give a lecture there in Heidelberg that changed his life forever. Here Luther again in 1519 and resolved to leave the Dominican order. And in 1523, he found refuge in the city of Strasbourg, where over the next generation, he would labor quietly, establishing a firm foundation for the Reformation in that great city. It was to Bucer that Calvin fled the first time he was kicked out of Geneva in 1538. It was to Bucer that Calvin fled when he realized that his life was falling apart, and what Bucer said was, "What you really need, Calvin, is a wife." And he found him one. It was Bucer that Luther and Zwingli turned to hammer out the details of their conflict regarding the Lord's Supper. It was Bucer that Melanchthon and Karlstadt turned to resolve the conflicts between the two of them. It was Bucer that Beza and Cranmer turned to resolve the difficulties between the English Reformation and the Genevan Reformation. It was Bucer who stood behind Melanchthon at the Augsburg hearings that brought forth the confession in 1530. It was Bucer that Cranmer turned to when he finally resolved to write a book of common prayer in 1549. Amazingly, Bucer never desired the limelight. He said of his work, "If I can serve standing away from the center of all of the drama, simply helping, serving, then I will have satisfied my deepest calling." He was a great second fiddle. A few years ago, one of our teachers in a tutorial program that we launched as a preparation to create an inner city Christian classical school sat down with one of our young boys at snack time and said to him, "Marquez, if you could be anything that you ever wanted to be when you grew up, what would you be?" Marquez said, "I'd play in the NFL. Now, wisely, the teacher said, "Well, Marquez, if you just couldn't play in the NFL, what would you want to be?" "Well, I guess I'd play in the NBA. "Well, Marquez, if you couldn't play in the NFL and you couldn't play in the NBA, what would you want to do then?" He said, "Well, I guess I could work at McDonald's." See, the problem is that Marquez had a false view of leadership and of calling. He thought that if he couldn't achieve his dream, if he couldn't actually be the next president of the United States, that he would just have to flip hamburgers for the rest of his life. This is the only model that he'd ever seen before. If he couldn't be an A-list leader, then he wouldn't be able to be a leader at all. G.K. Chesterton once said, "The most extraordinary thing in all the world is an ordinary man and an ordinary woman and their ordinary children. For the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Of such is the kingdom." See, the Bible constantly reminds us that the story of God's kingdom is a radical reversal of the common wisdom. More often than not, we find the heroic in the mundane, not in the profane. No, we find glory in commonness, not in prominence. Again and again, God demonstrates this basic principle of the kingdom. The weak in Abram's camp overwhelmed the strong in Chedorlaomer's camp, Genesis 14. The few in Gideon's army defeated the many in the Midianite army, Judges 7. David faced down Goliath, 1 Samuel 17. Elijah stood against Ahab, 1 Kings 16. Daniel faced down both lions and liars, Daniel 6. Shepherds and fig pickers were transformed into prophets before kings, Acts 7 says. See, God shames the wise, but he upholds the foolish, 1 Corinthians 1. He condemns the Pharisee, but he upholds and forgives the publican, Luke 18. He brings low the great, and he promotes the obscure, 1 Peter 5. He makes his power manifest, not in our strengths and gifts and abilities, but in our weaknesses and foibles and failures, 2 Corinthians 12. God makes something extraordinary out of the ordinary, Hebrews 11. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Of such is the kingdom. Now, although this is one of the most basic and primary themes in all of the scriptures, the men and women in Jesus' time, in fact, we ourselves, find it very difficult to comprehend. We're impressed by fame and celebrity. We're obsessed with prominence. So when we teach our students about leadership, we're constantly bringing before them generals and presidents and heroes and princes and kings. But the fact is that the biblical model of leadership is a model of service and of sacrifice, of laying down our lives, of not taking credit, of not grasping for the reins, not reaching for the brass ring. It's committing ourselves over the long haul, through the difficult tasks, slogging through when no one notices, fighting the good fight when there's no one to recognize, no one to offer applause, no one to award the plaque, no one to give the crystal bowl. The Bible tells us over and over again that the biblical view of true leadership is what we ought to be passing on to our students. There are several things that strike me about the lives of Melanchthon, Beza, and Bucer that made them so remarkable. I mean, we could talk about all of the obvious things, the 12 chivalric virtues which they manifested in abundance. They were trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. But beyond those obvious things, there were a number of things about these three men that I think we must learn from. First of all, They were captured by the vision. They were enraptured by the truth. They were transformed by the gospel. And as a result, they were able to let everything else go. Fame, celebrity, prominence, promise, ambition. Their ambitions were not diminished. They were heightened. It's just that they were so transformed that they were no longer recognized as ambitions, because they weren't ambitions for themselves. They were ambitions for the vision. Each one of them had Absalom moments where the followers of Luther and Calvin and the others came and said, Luther is just impossible. He's profane. He's uncontrollable. He runs so far ahead of us that none of us can keep up. They had those Absalom moments, and they set them aside for the sake of the vision. Secondly, Melanchthon, Beza, and Blutzer grasped the implications of the vision. It's not just that they were enraptured by the vision, they got it. They saw that not only would this vision change them, their family, their generation, their city, their culture, they saw how it would change the world, the whole world, from the rivers to the ends of the earth. They saw the glory of the Lord arise. They saw the implications right down to the finest details and made them practical. It made them diligent. It made them work. Third, because they were captured by the vision and because they grasped the implications, they thought strategically. If you ever read any of Calvin's works, you know that Calvin did not exactly think strategically. He wasn't thinking about the political implications of what he was saying, the cultural implications of what he was saying. He wasn't putting it together that with all of the Huguenot chocolatiers and watchmakers that were moving to Geneva, that someday we might be talking about Swiss chocolate and Swiss watches. He wasn't thinking like that. But Beza did. Beza saw it. Beza knew it. And Beza thought strategically to organize it. He assembled the details. He mobilized the troops. He let the people know that the grand and glorious vision of Calvin could be translated into the most intimate details of life. That's what a second fiddle does. It may be difficult to capture a visionary in Earth's orbit, but second fiddles always find a way. Fourth, Melanchthon, Beza, and Blutzer could always appreciate the public gifts of their leaders and separate those public gifts from their private flaws. This is perhaps the most remarkable character trait of all. They understood that those public gifts were not to be despised. They understood that those public gifts were absolutely essential. They understood that those public gifts were the means of grace that God used in their lives to change them forever. But they also understood that those public gifts were not sufficient for the whole task of reformation. And they understood that those public gifts, which oftentimes concealed the private flaws We're to be bolstered. We're to be held accountable. And we're to be utilized for the glory of God and not for the glory of Luther or Calvin or Cranmer or Zwingli. Oftentimes what happens when lieutenants come into a very flawed but very dynamic situation is that they try to marginalize the leader, separate him from the details. His flaws are obvious. Luther was not exactly a people person. Melanchthon said, once a monk, always a monk. It explained how it was that these grand public affairs, when the University of Wittenberg would host grand conferences, as soon as Luther was done speaking, he just disappeared. He ran back to Kate and beer. It was Melanchthon who was left to build the relationships, and he never despised this task. He saw it as an essential part of the diversity of gifts, the economy of God, the division of labor, separation of powers, checks and balances. He understood it, in other words, covenantally. He reveled in it. Fifth, Melanchthon, Beza, and Bucer were unafraid of controversy. They knew the controversy would come because Luther and Calvin were controversy magnets. Visionaries always are. They also knew that as they hammered out the details of Reformation in their cities and as the ideas of the Reformation spread, that there would be even more controversies. There would be splinters and spin-offs and slight adjustments, and that these would create friction within the fold. And they were committed to enter into those controversies, wade fully in, never shying away, because they understood that in the midst of peacemaking is the glory of the kingdom. And so, over and over and over again, when we see Luther and Zwingli battling it out, there's Bucer. There's Melanchthon standing behind the scenes whispering to each other, no, he really didn't mean that. There's this great description of the end of the council that was held, the Marburg Colloquy, where Luther is just taken the knife out of his belt and slammed it into the center of the table, and Zwingli is sitting there in tears, and Luther storms out, and Bucer and Melanchthon are standing there kind of thinking, oh, what do we do now? And immediately, both of them went to Zwingli. They laid their hands upon the weeping Swiss reformer. And they said, this shall not divide us. We have eternity together, to be sure. And with tears in their eyes, they followed after the charging bull of Luther and upheld them both. Sixth, Melanchthon and Beza and Bucer all had lives. They had families. They had children. They had fun. Stories abound of Melanchthon's garden parties, of Beza's delighting and hosting little dramas in his home, of Bucer gathering all of the pastors of the neighboring parishes in his back garden to regale them in Latin poetry and his dear wife's best beer. They had lives. They understood that as they pushed forward the great work of the Reformation, they were supposed to revel in the ordinary things. That it was in the midst of those ordinary things that their extraordinary callings would ultimately emerge. They taught all of the young men rising up through the Genevan Academy, all of those young preacher boys that came up through the Strasbourg system, all of the students at Wittenberg, they taught them that they were to have lives too, that the gospel ultimately, that the lordship of Christ ultimately demanded it. They beckoned their young charges to move out of the cage stage of Reformation zeal and into the richness and the beauty of life. That's something that really only a servant leader can exhort us to do, can model for us to see. Your students need to know that it's not likely that any of them will ever become president of the United States. Your students need to know that almost none of them will actually become A-list leaders. We oftentimes talk blithely in classical school circles of raising up the next generation of leaders, bringing along the next Calvin, the next Luther, the next Patrick Henry, the next Dante. That's God's job. Our job is to teach our students how to serve. And to step aside from their vain ambitions and imaginations. How to yield themselves fully to the glory of the gospel. How to be captured by the vision. How to grasp its implications. How to think strategically. How to appreciate public gifts, but be able to separate them from private flaws. How to enter into peacemaking, unafraid of controversy. How to have a life. Most of our students will be leaders like us. And so we have to teach them leadership for the rest of us. That glorious kind of leadership. The leadership of the kingdom. Fortunately, our teacher was very wise with Marquez. And said, Marquez, do you want to flip hamburgers at McDonald's? He said, well, no. I want to play in the NFL. Marquez, let's find lots of things that you want to do. Marquez, let's find ways for you to change the world, whether you ever step on a football field or a basketball court ever again. And if you're supposed to work at McDonald's, let's make sure you're the manager. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of the platitudes, the bumper sticker slogans, the success models that our society raises up. Wear us out. I find that oftentimes they're my chief discouragement. I mean, I know what the scriptures say about adversity and difficulty. When I'm in the midst of that adversity and difficulty, though, what I hear are the siren songs of my culture rather than the promises of Scripture. And so, slogging through the ordinary details, attending to yet one more board meeting, where we delay action on an agenda item that should have been decided 3 years ago, and I find myself dogged by Churchill's black dog, it's then that I most need to remember that God's model for leadership is far different from ours. Give your students a vision of service. Give your students a vision of sacrifice. Equip your students to be second fiddles. Raise them up to labor out of bounds, beyond the limelight. Cause your students to be so captured by the vision of the gospel that they don't care who gets credit as long as the world is changed by the grace and the mercy of Jesus Christ. Then we will know that what we have done is good and right and true. Then we will not weary in well-doing. God bless you.